If you're looking at your phone right now, you've found us on mobile, which means we can get a move on. You know me, you know what this is, so let's begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Another year of college, 1 year closer to real life, another $40,000 in debt for some of you, another summer to contemplate whether you're on the right track or have made a dreadful mistake. For you proud graduates and you professors and administrators actually working in higher ed, real life is now. All the fears, challenges, and excitement of college this week on The Takeaway. We're going to have a series of conversations called College Compass. Universities and students set a course for their futures. These futures are different, but equally full of disruptions. Is a college degree worth the price, some ask? Are there other ways to learn than being on campus for 4 years? What are the issues of sexual abuse, the distortions caused by dominant college athletic programs, funding support declining, and student indebtedness increasing? Today we hear from Anna Marie Causey, the interim president of the University of Washington. It's a big school with all of the challenges I mentioned, as well as some of its own. Causey says as a big state school, the home of the Huskies needs to make sure the door is open to all, but the educational product is not in any way compromised.
The University of Washington is deeply committed to both access and excellence, and the issue of diversity is critical to both of them. The demographics of our population is changing, and particularly so amongst youth. And if we're going to have the kind of educated workforce that we want and that we need, we really need to have access to all citizens. And we need to make sure that they not only get into the university, but that when they're there, that they thrive and they find it to be a supportive environment. So focusing on diversity is the right thing to do. Just as importantly, it's the smart thing to do. But this is an issue that we're struggling with in our society at large. This is not a University of Washington problem. It's not a university problem. It's a societal problem. But I think universities and the University of Washington is a really good place to begin some of the hard work of dealing with it.
And you and your family have been doing that hard work really going back a couple of generations now. Tell me your story and how your even university experience was helped or hindered by your particular background.
Well, I think in many ways I represent the American dream in the sense of my parents came to this country as a result of the Cuban Revolution. I was 3 years old, and they, you know, worked as factory workers and at minimum wage and basically reinvented their lives but managed to provide for their children. I was not privileged economically, but I was privileged in coming from a home where education was highly valued, and there was never any question but that my brother and I would go to college. The question was more of how we were going to pay for it. Both of us ended up going to universities, and at this point, I'm a university president. So in that sense, I represent the American dream, but there have been lots of, struggles along the way, and my brother didn't make it. He went to Duke University after a year in community college, and I think that Duke, very much like Yale, which I went to for graduate school, are these very wealthy universities surrounded by poverty, and particularly in North Carolina, you have a lot of black poverty surrounding the university, and I think that my brother's consciousness was raised. After graduating, he became very involved as a civil rights activist and also a union organizer. And in the South, when you're doing union organization and trying to bring together white and black workers, you sometimes run into the Klan. And he was one of the organizers of the first anti-Klan rally, and the Klan showed up and five people were murdered, and he was one of them. So in that sense, I know what the end result of discrimination and bias can be, and what these, what some people consider small things, the wrong word, a not particularly welcoming action, end up building an environment that can lead to pretty devastating consequences.
And we're talking about an event that didn't happen, you know, in the 50s or 60s. This is 1979.
Absolutely. It was 1979. I was 23. He was 25. In 1 second, an entire future for our family was gone. But, you know, I've had difficulties in my life, but I am very much coming at this from the viewpoint of love. I think that this is about creating a respectful and welcoming environment for everybody.
And I'm sure the people in the community of the University of Washington are thrilled and are moved by your perspective on this. And you're a tenured professor in the departments of psychology and American ethnic studies. And
yes.
Where do you think we are in America right now? What stage? There's been, you know, the Obama presidency has been 8 years to really reflect on the potential for transforming the racial discussion in the United States. I think there was a lot of hope at the beginning of the Obama administration. I think there was a lot of cynicism in the middle. I think as things begin to wind down for the Obama administration and looking at what's going on in places like Ferguson and now Baltimore, I'm wondering if there isn't a tragic but yet invigorated sense of this is something we really need to talk about. And how would you as an academic view what's going on? It's sort of sociology in real time.
Well, I think we really are in a crossroads. I think that for a lot of people, the Obama presidency represented, okay, now we've really become a colorblind society. And a lot of our youth has really been raised with this ideology that the way that you deal with difference is to, in essence, be blind to it or ignore it. And that's led to a lot of difficulties, both in terms of being able to make the most positive uses of diversity, but also it's led to some real difficulties in talking across groups. So you see universities right now, they're more diverse than they've ever been, and yet you often see different cultural groups or different racial groups kind of sitting in their own groups in the cafeteria and doing activities separately. To that degree, I think that this ethos of colorblindness has actually not been helpful. And one of the things that we really need to do to capture the best of diversity and to make sure that it leads to innovations and into new ideas and into success is to, first of all, be able to recognize it. It's very important if we're going to move forward on difficult issues, we have to be willing to take risks and to be bold.
Professor Anamari Kausay is the interim president of the University of Washington. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
And later this week, we're continuing our conversation by talking about the price of college, whether you're a high school student, a parent, a recent graduate. We want to hear from you. What questions do you have about paying for higher education? Or if you've graduated, how do you pay back your loans? Mel B. from Orange County, New York, writes on our website, how much should parents save for college for a child? I've heard of the one-third rule, save a third of the cost of college, pay a third of the college costs from current income, and borrow a third of college costs. Is that a good rule of thumb? And if so, how does one estimate the costs of college 18 years from now?
Hi, this is John DeLugos. I'm calling from Woodstock, Connecticut. I'm a single parent with two kids who will both be in college in 6 to 7 years, respectively. And with little saved for them now and few possibilities for increasing my income significantly, what's the best financial strategy for getting both of them into decent colleges and through colleges? They both do well academically, but that doesn't seem to be a big part of the equation, although maybe it is.
Hi, my name is Kyle Magarevitz from New Jersey. I graduated from college several years ago, and I have crippling debt from attending college and actually obtaining my master's. My biggest question is, what am I supposed to do at this point? I make $400 payments, and 85% of that payment goes towards interest. That's just one of my loans. How am I supposed to afford the rest?
Your questions on paying for college, 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Tweet us at The Takeaway. We'll bring you some answers later this week.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Technology is not universal. Just because something works in one place doesn't mean it will fit an environment where the assumptions and priorities are different. I'm reminded of years ago, MIT's One Laptop Per Child project got hung up when in testing in some places in the developing world, this intended educational device for children was instead used by parents as a light for nighttime. Some MIT engineers are facing the same challenges as they try to make a new and improved wheelchair work with local materials, simple, easy-to-find bicycle components, and a design that addresses the unpredictable terrain in rural villages. The Leveraged Freedom Chair, as it's known, has been tested in Tanzania, Guatemala, and India and has proved so popular that the engineers have come up with a new version of the chair for another place known for unpredictable urban terrain, the American market. Amos Winter and Benjamin Judge are co-founders of Grit, the startup company behind the chairs. Winter is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at MIT, and Judge is a product development engineer. The story begins with them explaining how this new chair is propelled.
Any conventional style wheelchair that you propel by grabbing the push rims is pretty arduous to propel if you have to go, say, 2 miles on a rough dirt track to get from your home to school or home to a job. And so it was that kind of mountain bike for your arms type scenario that we were trying to address. So the real novel feature of our chair is that you effectively change gears by just grabbing the levers at different points. So if you grab very high on our levers, you get a long lever length, produce a lot of leverage, and can produce the torque to go through mud, sand, steep hills. But if you slide your hands down the levers closer to the pivots, every time you push on the levers, you now go through a longer stroke and a bigger angle, and that makes the wheels spin faster. So we get a larger range of mechanical advantage than a standard 10-speed bicycle, and it enables our wheelchair to go about 80% faster than a regular wheelchair on a dirt road and produce 50% more force on the ground than you could with a standard push rim chair. And then the other big merit of this design is that the person is the most complex part of the machine. The person is doing that complex mechanical task of shifting their hands up and down the levers and acting like a derailleur would on a conventional bicycle. So because the person's doing that complex task, the drivetrain itself can be a very simple assembly of just a single-speed bicycle chain drive. So the drivetrain is really robust and low cost.
Isn't there also a sanitation issue with using the push rims in the developing world where your hands are pretty much on the treads of the wheel in addition to the push rim, and whatever's on the road is going to get on your hand?
That's correct, John. Your hands can get pretty muddy and dirty, but the other sanitation issue with mobility devices in developing countries is that if you use a tricycle, you can picture it like a bicycle that you pedal with your hands that has 3 wheels, those are typically much too large to use indoors. So when you do go indoors and go to the bathroom, you have to crawl on the floor. So we wanted to make a product that would be small enough to fit into a bathroom.
And tell me about that front wheel, Ben.
Sure. So the front wheel, we have a larger front wheel than you would see on a typical wheelchair. We do that, one, to roll over the really rough rocks. It allows us to have a longer wheelbase, so the amount of bumps that you feel would be less. And the great thing about that front wheel, we take this inspiration from the bicycle industry. We use all bicycle components, so that what's molded into that rubber wheel is a front bike hub. So it's nice and repairable. You're rolling it through the mud and whatnot, and need to service it, you can bring it into a bike shop and have it fixed.
Now, how do you develop a product for the United States urban market from a product in the developing world? And the needs, I suspect, would be completely different.
Not as much as you would think. Turns out that a pothole in Bombay is just as a problem as going through a pothole in Boston. So we actually heard from U.S. users themselves when they had witnessed what we were doing in developing countries that, like, hey, this would be a great thing for me to go in my farm, in my, going throughout Boston with all this construction, going,
hiking trail through the snow.
Yeah, all sorts of scenarios that we were experiencing in developing countries that people experience in the U.S. as well. So what we did is we actually took the developing world chair that we had developed and worked with U.S. users and kind of took it through their normal course of use and said, okay, what works for you? What doesn't work for you?
But we had to realize that users in the U.S. were going to transport this chair in their car. And we had to make it break down quickly, have quick-release wheels, collapsible frame. We had to make it serviceable in the U.S., so use U.S. bike part standards. So I think what's powerful about this message is that the core technology has been unchanged, and we can still promote mobility in rough terrain, but we've been able to tailor the technology for the specific needs of users in different parts of the world.
Finally, who's been changed? Tell me the story of someone in your development process who you could see was changed by this product.
Sure. I think the best example that we have is of Ashok.
Yeah.
So Ashok was a tailor in India, and he had a successful tailoring business. He unfortunately sustained a spinal cord injury when he fell out of a tree, and you know was effectively turned into a burden on his household. He was you know his family had to take care of him instead of him providing for his family. We were able to get him a Freedom Chair. And he was the next day he was able to reopen his tailoring business. It was quite this inspirational story. We have this great image of him, you know, propelling himself to his store, followed by people in his village. And he's now back to being the breadwinner of his family.
Yeah, the barrier to getting to his shop from his house was less than a kilometer of dirt road that had a drainage ditch in the middle of it. And he couldn't get over that with a regular wheelchair. And with ours, he was able to.
So kind of a thrill for two engineers from MIT.
Absolutely.
Amos and Benjamin, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
Amos Winter and Benjamin Judge are co-founders of Grit, the startup company behind the leveraged Freedom Chair. Winter is an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at MIT. Judge is a product development engineer. You can see photos of the Freedom Chair at thetakeaway.org. Later this week, we're talking about paying for college, whether you're planning for your child's education or trying to pay off your own student loans. What questions do you have about the whole process?
Hey, this is Sarah from Atlanta. I'm a recent graduate just out of college, and my student loan payback plan is now about $250 a month, and some months it can be a bit steep for me. So my question is, what are the repercussions of not being able to pay back your loans on time every month?
Another good question. Let's have more of them at 8778-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Squarespace, providing users with tools to create websites for small business or their own personal brand. More information at squarespace.com/takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Here's a quick appeal. The more subscribers we have, the easier it is for us to attract the sponsors to keep our show going. So if you like the program, please let folks know. A Facebook like or a follow on Twitter means so much. Thanks again for downloading this podcast, which is brought to you by the fine folks at WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Last week, the National Football League, America's jumbled cultural symbol of national unity, testosterone, violence, misogyny, money, cheating, loyalty, team spirit, celebrity ego, eloquence, and profanity, experienced some gas pains. It is apparently clear to the league that Super Bowl champion MVP quarterback Tom Brady ordered that his footballs be deflated to below the regulation pressure to improve his grip in last year's playoff game against the Indianapolis Colts. Because Brady's balls were too soft, the league is inclined to play hardball and suspend the star, fine the team, and then go back to printing money, which is what the NFL mostly does, since nothing apparently can diminish American enthusiasm for football. Americans will even watch a three-day stretched-out NFL draft that is about as exciting as reading a telephone book in Latin. What's a telephone book, you say? What's Latin, you ask? Which is exactly how some Patriots fans are just shrugging this whole thing off.
It's not 100%, you know, that he did it. They say he could have, he couldn't have, you know? It could have been anything.
I don't believe that they did anything wrong, nor do I believe that Tom Brady did. He's a stand-up guy. All the guys on the team seem that way, from the coach to the owner to the rest of them. They're just awesome.
Awesome, and, you know, we'll never, ever really know. Those voices courtesy of our partner WGBH in Boston. And here's Patriots tight end Rob Gronkowski's response, courtesy, it sounds like, of the World Wrestling Federation.
They're worried about a story for the Deflategate. You know, These sure aren't deflating. These are only inflating. So get ready, because I'm going to be ready.
If you haven't seen that video, and in case you're worried, Mr. Gronkowski is showing off his biceps there. A few people's balloon got popped here. Steve Buckley, columnist from the Boston Herald, talking to WGBH's Emily Rooney, can't get the tarnish off his football idols.
If the two gentlemen in question were to come forward and completely say this was a rogue activity, they acted on their own, I have a hard time saying this. I'm grasping for some measure of solace for Tom Brady. But if they could come forward and say, well, he always said he wanted the footballs at this, so we took it upon ourselves, and maybe we overdid it, and poor Tom has no knowledge of this.
Right. And then there were others who matched the NFL's legendary self-righteousness with some of their own. Here's Boston TV and radio personality John Keller.
A sport replete with cheating. Every time a penalty flag is thrown, it's cheating that's been caught. Tripping, grabbing, clutching. Imagine what goes on at the bottom of those scrums when there's a loose ball. And half the time, they get away with it. So please, ease off on the over-the-top self-righteousness. That's all I'm asking for.
What does it say, all these charges coming after the Super Bowl? What's the NFL to do? Do you suspend Tom Brady so he can stay home with his supermodel wife? That will show him. Patriots coach Bill Belichick, what do you do to him? Fine him, and he won't be able to afford that fancy wardrobe of hooded sweatshirts, white socks, and sneakers? What could the NFL do? Make Brady play with Nerf balls? Force Belichick to wear a suit on the sidelines and speak in complete sentences? Some of our listeners are hoping for something that will sting.
Steve calling from New York City. I'm hoping that the Deflategate will definitely ruin his legacy. Brady and Coach Cheater have been getting away with some type of dishonest mayhem for years.
Hi, this is Lama from New York City. Doesn't everything on the Brady and Patriots victory list have an asterisk next to it now? And I'm a former Pats fan.
This is Kevin from Dedham, Massachusetts. And it will make a difference in a lot of people's minds, tarnish their image, but it really shouldn't.
Right, Kevin. It's a little like all the speculation about declining ratings for football. I hate to burst your balloon, but it's not going to happen. Staying with food now.
Have you seen the little piggies crawling in the dirt?
Pigs are cute, disgusting, forbidden, required, delicious, unhealthy, rare, common, lean, fat, white meat, dark meat, slow-cooked, pan-fried, big and little. They've been tempting and confounding civilization for more than 3,000 years. Tamed, domesticated pigs joined the barnyard in 1000 BC, and it's been one greasy, crispy, lean and tender meal after another ever since. There is a recipe for absolutely every part of the pig. Did you know that? Especially this time of year when the grill is hot. Mark Essig, author of Lesser Beasts, A Snout-to-Tail History of the Humble Pig, joins us. Lesser beasts, you say, Mark?
I actually took the term from a history of agriculture in which cows were given a chapter to themselves, but then the pigs were consigned to a catch-all chapter called the Lesser Beasts, even though this was a history of agriculture in the United States, and I would make a strong argument that pigs have actually been more important to the history of the U.S.
What is unusual about pork in that it has caused so much sort of controversy and consternation among the world's religions?
I think where I would start is just how useful the pig is. They reproduce incredibly quickly, far more quickly than cows or sheep. They have very large litters. They grow to the weight that they can be slaughtered and eaten much more quickly than those other animals. And most crucially, their meat cures well in salt. So that means you could keep it around for a long time, even before the era of artificial refrigeration, which is a very recent invention. That's the good side of pigs. The bad side of pigs is that they will eat anything, including incredibly disgusting things like garbage from the streets, dead animals, even human waste. For that reason, among others, pigs got the reputation of being filthy creatures, and so people who could afford to eat other things refused to eat pork. This was especially true in the ancient Near East when Judaism developed. The priests who wrote the rules handed down to us in the book of Leviticus, they were in the upper crust, and virtually nobody in the region ate pork, and so they codified the prejudice against these animals as part of religious rules. They were very concerned with purity. The pig was more or less the definition of the impure animal, so in order to remain pure, they had to avoid any contact with pigs or pork.
Why is it that pigs can eat anything and they taste the same?
Well, pigs do vary in flavor very much. For instance, what cows eat is expressed in their milk, but less so in their flesh. Whereas pigs, they lay down the fat in the same form that they consume it. So if you have a pig that eats acorns or peanuts, those are unsaturated fats. They have a very soft fat. It doesn't keep as well, but it's delicious. That's why certain Spanish hams are very expensive and very prized, because they're very soft and they taste of the acorns that the pig ate. If you had a pig that ate mostly, say, rotten fish from the fishmongers, and these are things that did happen, that would not be a very delicious type of pork.
So it would be fishy smelling pork.
It would be a very fishy smelly pork.
And pigs have such personality, and you talk about this. I mean, they're adorable little creatures.
They have such expressive faces. When you look, I've worked with pigs on a farm, and when you look at them, you can just tell that there is much more going on behind those eyes than tends to be the case with a cow or a sheep. And a lot of people think a lot of scientists have argued that this could relate to the diet of the pig. Pigs, like people, are omnivores. If you have a cow or a sheep, their main decision is if they see something green, they can start chewing it. Whereas if you've got a pig or a person, if they can eat anything, they're not limited to plants. But that involves a judgment. You have to know whether this new food source is safe or it's not safe.
The fact that humans in the United States are appalled by the consumption of dogs and, to a lesser extent, horses suggests that Americans in particular have some problem with animals that can be anthropomorphized, that you can imagine as pets, which would tend to disqualify pigs as food, but they're a very central part of the U.S. diet. That seems like a contradiction.
Yeah, the connection between pigs and dogs, they're deep and they go back to the beginning. For one thing, it's thought that both of them became domestic by being village scavengers. When people first settled down into villages 10,000 years ago, you get a group of people together. One of the things they do best is produce garbage. And the pigs, these were Eurasian wild boars, started lurking around the villages to devour the garbage. And gradually, a certain number of those got particularly good at this. They filled this new niche within human society and found this new source of food, and they evolved along separate lines to be able to live alongside people. And it's thought that even earlier than that, dogs were domesticated in the same way. The development of dogs as pets changed that relationship. There's no logical reason to explain why it's okay to eat a pig and it's not okay to eat a dog. Those are entirely cultural conventions.
One of the things that's interesting about pigs, distinguished from other meat sources, is that almost all meat sources, fish and beef, certainly lamb, chicken, are valued most in their freshest form, maybe to a little lesser extent with beef. But with pork, it's almost reversed. The cured varieties of pork are maybe as popular, if not more popular, than fresh pork chops or fresh pork roast.
In part, it's a question of technique. People got very good at curing pork and making it palatable simply because there was so much of it around. The reason that pork cures so well has in part to do with it tends to be fattier, and that allows something to dry out and still stay moist, whereas beef would become more like jerky, very shoe leathery rather than soft and succulent.
And you need bacon on just about anything.
Some would make that case. Some of us would say that the cult of bacon has perhaps gone a little bit overboard over the past few years.
Mark Essig, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Pleasure to be here.
Mark Essig is the author of Lesser Beasts, a snout-to-tail history of the humble pig. And here's something to take with you today, speaking of the grilling season. As the days get longer here in the Northern Hemisphere, the sunsets are later. The orange-tinted dusk of Earth with its brilliant yellow sun disk comes after 8 in the evening these days. They say a really colorful, pretty sunset is a sign of contaminants. I guess kind of like listening to Don Henley and the Eagles too much. On Mars, NASA reports that dust storms outdo earthly air pollution. The tiny little pinhole sun was captured by the rover Curiosity at sunset. And it turns out that sunset on the red planet is actually a cold blue, to go with a temperature of 100 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. Romantic.
She wore blue velvet. Bluer than velvet was the night.
That's all for today, but fear not. You can ask me anything on Twitter. Every day I take your questions, sometimes your complaints. I do my best to get back to you personally. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry. And if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. Take us with you on your commute home from work. Find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Warmer than May, her tender sighs. Love was ours. Ours, love I held tightly. Feeling the rapture grow.
PRI, Public Radio International.